First, a little tribute to Jerry. You know, we went on many sampling campaigns together, and he always got down and got dirty doing the sampling. So, we first, you know, he was always a even during turbulent times, he's always a gentle, positive force, and so it was a pleasure working with him. And we first started collaborating about, I think, 1999. He was in the back of the loading dock dumping out his containers that he put on the gamma ray spectrograph. And I asked him what he was doing, and then we started talking about research and started our collaboration. And at the time, I was working on repairing wetland, and was puzzled by a pattern of carbon distribution in the wetland. But what we noted was there was an area of what I call post-sediment deposit that was on top of the original histic-type material in the wetland, high organic matter wetland soil. But on the top of the mineral layer that was deposited due to agricultural activity, there's a layer of new carbon formed, or new high carbon layer on top of that mineral deposit. And so the question is, what was causing this? What was the dynamic in the wetland that was causing this pattern of carbon? And so with Jerry's use of radioisotope tracers, we started a very useful collaboration looking at that. And about the same time in 1998, Stallard came out with a hypothesis, was rather provocative, in which he say the erosion removes carbon from the upland and deposits it into, or essentially buries it in lakes, reservoirs, peatlands, and oceans. And that carbon sequestration is stimulated in the uplands because of the removal of carbon, and then, of course, you get passive storage of that carbon at the sites of deposition. So this is a whole hypothesis as to how erosion can actually stimulate carbon sequestration in the terrestrial ecosystem. Of course, we know with agriculture, there's a lot of carbon being lost from agricultural croplands, primarily due to erosion. The question becomes, what is the fate of that carbon? Is it given off as CO2, or is it stored someplace else in the ecosystem, in the terrestrial ecosystem? Erosion is a massive force in agricultural systems. There's estimates of 75 gigatons of soil lost from croplands per year, which translates into about 0.5 to 2 gigatons of carbon loss. So we equate soil loss with erosion. And primarily that comes about through, because we're looking at plots and plot studies. And when we look at something that's lost from the plot, then it's just lost. But actually, erosion, only about 10% of it's actually in a typical watershed exported. The rest of it, 90% of it, is a redistribution of soil resources within the watershed. So, the biogeochemical models assessing fate of carbon in terrestrial systems still largely equate soil loss with our carbon loss with soil erosion, and that's because the models are primarily calibrated using plot study data. So the negative, there's obvious negative impacts of soil erosion. It's thought to disrupt the physical protection of soil carbon associated with soil particles, and perhaps 20% of the eroded carbon is mineralized as a result of decreased protection. But the net impact of erosion depends on the fate of carbon at the sites of deposition. An important concept to get a hold of is what the pedogenic equilibrium for soil carbon is at a landscape position. The capacity of soil to hold carbon is a product of climate, mineralogy, and vegetation. Now, the biogeochemical models handle these parameters very well in estimating carbon storage capacity. But there's also landscape position is important. Anyone that goes out and samples soils knows that that there's a lot of spatial structure to soil's carbon, and that's a function of these landscape processes. And these landscape processes are not necessarily handled well by the biogeochemical models that are presently used. With soil erosion, but we're causing the soil to come out of disequilibrium with the pedogenic equilibrium, and so what that does then is it stimulates formation of new soil carbon as a result of that stress. And as long as we don't exceed the elastic limit of the spring, then the soil carbon value will tend to go back to its original position. So what happens when you move soil across a landscape? Often what you're doing is you're moving soil across or along a biogeochemical gradient within the landscape. For example, in the uplands, you may have a pedogenic equilibrium of 2% carbon, whereas in a depressional area, which may be a wetland, for example, you could have a pedogenic equilibrium of 20% carbon. And so what happens when you redistribute carbon resources from these uplands to these lowland areas? And a hypothesis that we tested was that there's a correlation between the redistribution and the biogeochemical gradient within a landscape. So at the site of erosion, you can have this type of a situation where you have increasing erosion, and because removing carbon from that position, you can get a stimulation of carbon sequestration. But if you erode the site too much, you destroy its potential, or you exceed its elastic limit, and then that you can get a degradation in your net primary production, which will then tend to decrease the amount of carbon sequestration. So without too much erosion, you can degrade the ability of the site to sequester carbon. So what Jerry and I worked with was a number of chronological markers. You've heard a lot of talk about the cesium-137, which is a byproduct of atmospheric testing of fusion bombs. And then we have lead-210, which is a natural product formed from radon decay in the atmosphere. And you get a deposition on the land surface, and it's good for looking at depositional sites. It has a half-life of about 22 years. And then, of course, C14 for dating carbon. So with cesium-137, what we assume is that you get a uniform deposition on your landscape. You use a reference site to estimate what the original deposition was, and then you look at the redistribution of your cesium inventory on the landscape, and that will give you sites of your estimates of sites of erosion and deposition within the landscape. With lead-210, we're looking at essentially deposition of atmospherically formed lead-210, formed from radon in the atmosphere, but also you have an internal source of lead-210 in soil, and so you have to be able to subtract that off, and what you're really interested in is in this, what we call unsupported lead-210 inventory in your soil profile. Okay, the site that we worked on, again, this is the site where I showed you where we had this post-settlement deposit, and on top we had the cap of new carbon being formed. This is an experimental watershed at OP3, commonly called at the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center. And we took a series of cores, intact cores, at the study site. And of course, this study site has a high potential for carbon formation or high net productivity. So there's a lot of carbon being formed and deposited in the wetland system throughout the year. So then what we looked at is, so this shows you the relationship between carbon and lead-210. And you see the remarkable correspondence between the two. This is the what I call the post-settlement deposit region within the wetland system. And you see this is the new carbon. This is the carbon cap formed on top of the post-settlement deposit. And you see very good correspondence between the lead-210 and the carbon. So what's causing this relationship? And so what we hypothesize is that essentially you're having a constant supply of both lead-210 and carbon residue from the wetland. And of course, then you have the lateral movement of mineral soil into the wetland system, causing dilution, and so you would predict that you would get strong correspondence between your lead-210 and your carbon in the profile. And so we developed a model for a mathematical model for that process. And so with that, we came up with modern estimates of mineral and carbon deposition within the wetland system. We can use the carbon-14 dates of the carbon in the wetland soil. As you see, the carbon date increases with depth. In the wetland system, and then they get the paraglacial event of about 2,000 or 12,000 years ago. So that's when this landform came into existence. And then, so we can use the carbon-14 dates to get the historic pre-modern estimates of deposition. You see they're much lower by essentially orders of two orders of magnitude lower for both mineral and carbon sequestration. And then we can look at the relationship between mineral deposition and carbon sequestration in the wetland system, and what this suggests is that the mineral deposition is a strong driver of carbon sequestration within the wetland system. So we demonstrated that, with this extreme situation where you got like maybe 2% carbon on the upland and 20% carbon in the wetland, how that can drive sequestration. The question is on a much, you know, does this also happen or operate on where you have lower gradients, for example, on an agricultural field? So this just shows you the carbon distribution on an agriculture field in relation to, in relationship to topographic position. So the carbon map was derived from a hyperspectral image, partial least squares regression, based upon partial least squares regression model. And the topography was derived from a high resolution LIDAR DEM. And you see that there's a strong relationship between topographic position and carbon. And there are two drivers of this. One is, you know, this is an agricultural field, so there's a lot of soil redistribution within the field. The other is the potential, you know, that there are biogeochemical gradients in the field. These lower areas tend to be wetter, and so they're going to have a different pedogenic equilibrium for carbon than the higher areas within the landscape that are going to be drier. So the topographic controls, there's a number of topographic parameters you can measure. One I think is a very useful measure is a wetness index, which predicts how water is going to distribute on a landscape. It's a function of contributing area and also slope at any given point within the landscape. And so because it predicts wetness, it probably is a good surrogate indicator of biogeochemical gradients within the landscape. Other parameters are mean curvature and slope. So this is we're going from Maryland now to Iowa. This is an Iowa landscape, a glacial till landscape. A young landscape, less than 12,000 years old, or about 12,000 years old. So it's poorly, you know, the drainage structure is poorly developed. A lot of closed basin type features on the landscape. So this shows you the risk in the background. What you see in the background is the wetness index calculated based upon a high-resolution DEM for that landscape. And then what we have here is the landscape was grid sampled, so at every point there we took a soil sample. And so we measured carbon and cesium in those. And what we see is a strong correspondence between, first of all, there's a strong correspondence between how much soil is lost at a site and how much carbon is at the site. So essentially, you know, the mollic epipedon that was on these hill slopes is now in the depressional areas. So you got low carbon on the hills. Hilltops, and you got high carbon in the depressional area, which corresponds to the cesium distribution. You got high cesium in the depressional areas, low cesium in the at the hill tops, and also you get to see a strong correspondence between the wetness index and both cesium and carbon. So as I said earlier, the wetness index is probably a strong predictor of the biogeochemical gradient within the landscape. And so this provides evidence that there's a systematic redistribution of carbon resources across biogeochemical gradients within that landscape, and likely increase the stability of eroded carbon based upon the redistribution patterns within the ecosystem. So the other thing is we can use these topographic parameters as to develop a regression model to estimate both erosion or deposition and carbon within the landscape. So we can develop, instead of interpolating using kriging, we can extrapolate using a regression model. So we can develop those type of models based upon topographic parameters, and then using a high resolution DEM created by LIDAR, we can predict what the carbon distribution is going to be at a watershed scale. We can also do this for erosion, and then use those within a biogeochemical model to estimate, you know, at the watershed scale, what impact erosion is going to have on carbon dynamics. And as I said, you know, the biogeochemical models are currently all calibrated using plot studies, which by default or by design eliminate landscape processes. And so these models do not well represent what's occurring on the landscape in terms of erosion, deposition, or the potential for biogeochemical gradients within the landscape. So it's time that we move beyond the plot study and look at these at water, you know, at watershed scale effects. I've extolled the virtues of erosion in terms of carbon sequestration. Obviously, we need to take into account, you know, that the importance of the conservation ethic, and this shows you the famous 1934 dust storm that came over Washington, D.C., that led to the formation of the Soil Conservation Service. And, you know, conservation practices have done a remarkable job in reducing the amount of erosion that's occurred. These studies do raise is a new paradigm where we can exercise the ecological springs by erosion that will promote carbon sequestration in agricultural ecosystems, as long as we don't exceed the elastic limit of the ecosystem. So that's. No.
Talking about the total carbon.
Just organic carbon.
Organic carbon.
Yep.
So, in your experience there, what you saw in the, those are heavily managed landscapes in Iowa and Midwest.
Yep.
If we have to apply this conservation practices, can we still accumulate carbon, or we are just slowing down the rate of loss?
You mean like no-till?
Well, there have been several practices like no-till.
Yeah.
Any kind of intervention, from what the literature suggests, is that it's going to somehow release carbon. So the only one suggested that have been something like the literature is just convert some of them into wetland and just forget
about it. Yeah.
But we cannot do it because we have to eat and feed the world. So what's your sort of take on that?
Well, I think a little bit of a highly conserved ecosystem actually saturates in carbon pretty quickly. If you go to like a no-till system, you saturate the within 20 years you've saturated the system in terms of carbon sequestration. So with a little bit of erosion, actually you can keep that going. And so, I'm not advocating that we till up all the soil. Just saying that, that you know, that, so that, you know, there are pluses and minuses to you know, going to conserved system, highly conserved systems.
You mean in the way that the erosion will move the carbon to an area where it's more stable?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But the erosion could have the other effect too. Have you seen the horizons in the depressions?
Seen what?
Inverted horizons. But this, you mentioned the mollies being at the top.
Yeah.
Well, due to erosion, what we have seen in northern Indiana, we have seen inverted erosions of the depressions. All that mollies are at the top has been.
Yeah, you know, it's all a matter of what happens at the sites of deposition in terms of net effect, whether you know erosion is positive or negative. If it's transported to a site where the carbon is more subject to oxidation, then erosion potentially has a negative effect. Even though at the site of erosion, you still there are studies showing that you still get increased sequestration at the site of erosion because you pull down the equilibrium value. But what I've seen at a wetland site is that by pulling down the equilibrium value by a deposition or dilution with mineral is that you also stimulate. So it's, you know, we need more study, we need biogeochemical models that take into account landscape processes that can give us a better answer at the large scale, at watershed scales, what the impact of erosion is. So,
one more question.
Yeah, I was just going to mention or just comment that many of these depositional areas, it's probably net deposition that you're looking at. There actually can be active locations of erosion from those areas as well.
Yeah.
Some of the sediment delivery ratios of 10%, if that increases and you have more delivery to surface waters,
yeah.
And you have a whole other dynamic that starts from the standpoint of those landscape processes to export carbon and also soil from those depositional areas as well.
Right. You got stream bank erosion, which is going to carry it further down, and eventually, you know, it all ends up in the ocean.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Okay.